Good afternoon. Welcome to the 10th annual meeting of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society. I'm Jim Barrett. I'm a managing director with Alvarez & Marsal and the president of the society for 2009-2010. On behalf of my fellow members of the society, I'd like to welcome all of you who are in the auditorium here at the SEC in Washington, D.C., as well as all of you who are joining us online at www.sechistorical.org. For the first time, we are broadcasting this meeting live through our website. Before our panelists begin their discussion on the future of the SEC, I would like to take some time to discuss the society and some of the work that we've been doing in preserving and sharing the financial regulatory system history from the 1930s to the present through our unique world-class virtual museum and archive. First, I'd like to congratulate the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission on its 75th anniversary of its founding on June 6, 1934. And since November of 2007, the Society has commemorated this anniversary through various educational and celebratory events throughout the United States. Today's annual meeting is the final educational event as part of that commemoration. In a few weeks, our 75th anniversary dinner will be here in Washington, D.C., that will culminate the commemoration. While the SEC Historical Society is independent of and separate from the SEC and receives no government funding, we are honored by the SEC's confidence in us to appropriately commemorate this milestone anniversary. We have enjoyed meeting many of the SEC and SEC alumni throughout the events this year. We appreciate the ongoing support that the SEC has extended to the society since our founding almost 10 years ago. While this past year has seemed to focus on the celebration of the 75th anniversary of the SEC, the real work of preserving and sharing the history of the financial regulatory system in the 20th and 21st century has continued and has grown. As I mentioned, our unique virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, you're going to memorize that by the time I'm done, celebrates its 7th anniversary this year. Today, the museum's collections, including papers, photos, oral histories, educational programs, a timeline, and galleries that bring together various materials on specific topics, now total more than 3,200 primary materials, the majority of which cannot be found anywhere else online. The museum currently welcomes more than 9,000 visitors a month from federal, state, and municipal agencies, including the SEC, law, financial services and accounting firms, self-regulatory organizations, and academia. I'm proud to say we are well on track to exceeding 100,000 visitors this year. And the museum continues to be free and accessible worldwide at all times. The museum is more than the history of one regulatory agency. It illuminates the actions, the impact, and the people of the many institutions which have shaped the markets, regulatory markets of the U.S. and the world since the 1930s. And we look ahead to reflecting further developments in the regulatory system. Thanks to the oversight of the Museum Committee, and today's panel has a number of the academic members of the Museum Committee, the museum collections continue to be objective and authoritative. As I stated earlier, the Society receives no government funding. We are solely supported by the gifts and grants of the individuals and institutions which help us build the museum and make it available at all times free of charge. While the Society, like other nonprofit organizations and other organizations in general, have been impacted by the current financial crisis, we are deeply grateful to all of you who continue to give and sustain this important work. We are also proud that we consistently commit over 70% of gift revenue each year directly to the growth and outreach of the Virtual Museum and Archive. This annual meeting also gives the Society an opportunity to welcome new leaders and retiring leaders. As I begin my tenure as president, I would like to recognize my fellow officers. They are David Martin of Covington and Burling, who is chairman, Susan Coffey of the AICPA, is president-elect, Stacy Chittick of FINRA and Donna Nagy of the University of Indiana School of Law, vice presidents, respectively, of development and the museum, Scott Bayless of Deloitte & Touche, who's treasurer, and Richard Nesson of the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation as secretary. I would also like to welcome our new trustees, the Honorable Cynthia Glassman, a former SEC commissioner and former Undersecretary for Economic Affairs, Economics and Statistics Administration, Department of Commerce, Angela Gelzer, Associate Vice President of FINRA, and Bob Kippers, Deputy CEO, Deloitte & Touche, who's a returning trustee. Finally, I would like to acknowledge the service of those retiring trustees, Mark Berman of CompliGlobe, Herb Janik of Bingham McCutcheon, and Colleen Mahoney of Skadden Arps, Slate, Meagher, and Flom as they retire. Mark, Herb, and Colleen are now among the 24 members of the class of 2012 of our Board of Advisors, which provides persons interested in the work of the Society with volunteer leadership opportunities without the governance and fiduciary responsibilities of the Board of Trustees. My fellow trustees look forward to working with all the members of the Board of Advisors to advance the work of the Society in the coming years. Today's annual meeting program, looking at the future of the SEC, has a timely topic, but its genesis actually comes from comments from Joel Seligman, the moderator of today's discussion, made nearly 8 years ago when he served as a founding member of the Society. At that time, Joel stated, "We are presuming that the SEC will go on forever as it is currently. That may not be the case. Let's not take the SEC for granted." This afternoon, to discuss the future of the SEC in light of possible changes in the financial regulatory system, please welcome from left to right, Robert Thompson, New York Alumni Chancellor's Professor of Law, Vanderbilt University Law School, Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law, the George Washington University Law School, Lyman Johnson, the Robert O. Bentley Professor of Law, Washington and Lee School of Law, Joel Seligman, President of the University of Rochester, Donald Langevoort, the Thomas Aquinas Reynolds Professor of Law, Georgetown University Law School, and Donna Nagy, C. Ben Dutton, Professor of Law, University of Indiana Morris School of Law at Bloomington. Joel, your comments 8 years ago seem now as a prophecy. We know that you and your fellow panelists will give us excellent insights into one of the most significant regulation issues of today. And I invite you to open the discussion.
Thank you. Appreciate the very warm and gracious introduction. Happy birthday, Deputy. For 75 years, you've been one of the great models of effective regulation. You, in effect, were a third way between, let's say, fair on the one hand, system that works. It is a system that has proven itself just by looking at the expansion of the number of investors, the global reach of the regulatory ideas of the Commission, the tremendous growth in our economy. Nonetheless, we meet, as was suggested in the earlier remarks, at a time of extraordinary uncertainty. We have, perhaps in the 75 years of the SEC, never had such fundamental questions.
Never. Is that better? Never in the 75-year history of the SEC have we had such profound questions posed about, should the SEC continue? Should there be a new approach to regulation, obviously not based on the kind of monoline approach that evolved from the 1930s, but one that takes into account financial supermarkets. How do we address systemic risk? How do we address the complexities of a plethora of new products, perhaps most notably OTC derivatives and various forms of swaps? How do we address new types of financial professionals, such as those in the hedge fund industry? How do we address the fact that the securities industry is no longer an island unto itself in the United States, but increasingly globalized? What do we do with the fact that financial professionals like broker-dealers and investment advisors, subject to separate systems of regulation administered by the SEC, are apparently indistinguishable to the retail public? How do we address concepts that we thought had been rejected as long ago as 1933, such as the revival of a call for merit regulation through a financial products commission? Does the SEC funding mechanism work? We have seen time after time that the SEC is well-funded in response to crisis, and then when the market picks up, its enforcement capacity consistently has lagged as you see dramatic increases in the size of market activity and essentially a static SEC. There are many, many questions that we could address. We'll only have the chance to really skim the surface on a few of them. But I'd like to begin with a question I'm going to ask each of the panel to ponder, and that is, we're today celebrating the 75th anniversary of the SEC. I think it is probable, but not certain, that at least some of us will be around to celebrate on June 6, 2034, the 100th anniversary of the SEC. Let me put the case as crisply as I can. Should there be an SEC 25 years from now? Is it an agency with great historical achievements in the past, or does it have a role in the future that's fundamental and enduring? And let me start alphabetically with Teresa.
Thank you. I feel very firmly that there will be an SEC and that there should be an SEC in another 25 years. From a starting point, I think about how could anyone conceive of handing over significant financial regulation to an agency that is not independent, that is not bipartisan? Those are two things that distinguish the SEC, and I feel, again, most people would agree should be continued. It certainly is true that the SEC has been required in the past to be very innovative in working with legislation that was adopted in 1933 and basically set into stone for at least a while some of the assumptions about the way the world worked in 1933. It's proven itself to be extremely innovative in dealing with some of those problems. Certainly it hasn't been able to resolve all of them as neatly as one might like, but we have seen a great deal of innovation. In addition, I do think that the history of the SEC is otherwise a generally illustrious one. From the time I was a very young lawyer, I remember hearing about the SEC being the cops on the beat. It was the agency, probably the premier agency. It had a lot of luster. There may have been some bumps in the road now and again, but again, I think it is an agency that commands a great deal of respect. In the short term, I think that it would be devastating to investor confidence to dismantle the SEC. And from a long-term perspective, it wouldn't make a lot of sense to me to throw out some things that basically do work because a few things along the line haven't worked quite so well. I probably will sound like a little bit of an SEC apologist here, but as I was working on a supplement to a casebook recently, I was thinking about what to tell the students in my securities regulation class about studying securities law and focusing on the SEC and what it does in this day and age, and came away having written something that I think will try and communicate very firmly to my students that there is an SEC, and very many of the things that the SEC has done and has done well will continue.
Thanks, Teresa. Lyman, what's your view? Will there be an SEC in 2034? And maybe the more important aspect of the question, should there be?
Joel, I think it's interesting simply to ask the question. And perhaps we would ask it just because it's the 75th anniversary. But I suspect we're asking the question because of dramatic developments that we've witnessed in the financial markets in recent times. Last fall, when we saw grave financial peril in the financial markets, perhaps it was only the Treasury and the Fed that could intervene in the way that they did. And their intervention did change the financial and the regulatory landscape as they married up versus financial institutions, commercial banks, and iBanks, as they essentially nudged the last remaining investment banks into their own hands under the Bank Holding Company Act, as they became an insurer of money market deposits, much like bank deposits, and other actions yet, essentially owning an insurance company and now an automobile company. This has changed the regulatory landscape. I think it has given certain people a sense of momentum that perhaps it is Fed and Treasury that should be the regulator of choice. And I think this has led many people to advocate an increased federalization of regulation and at the federal level an increased consolidation of regulation. And I think it's incumbent on various administrative agencies, the SEC being notable today, to remind various constituencies that it has a strong historic record, as Joel and Teresa have indicated, that it has remarkable strengths in its commitment, unwavering to investor protection. So I think it's important to acknowledge regulatory shortcomings. There are some. And to advocate where constructive change can take place. And there's a host of areas, whether it's the over-the-counter derivatives market mentioned by Joel, or hedge fund regulation of some kind, or credit rating agencies, or harmonizing the regulatory schemes of investment advisors and broker-dealers, and even upping the arsenal of sanctions available to SEC enforcement officials. I think it's important to focus on those constructive areas where the historic mission of the SEC can be strengthened. And I think if that is done so, I think that there's no question that the SEC will be here in 2034 and probably far beyond that.
Don, when Teresa was offering her analysis, she in effect paraphrased the old adage that the SEC is the cop on Wall Street. Does Wall Street still exist the way it used to be? Are we dealing in a world that has become so globalized? The very nature of the regulatory challenge of the Commission has sufficiently fundamentally changed that the question, will we have the chance to celebrate the 100th birthday of the SEC on June 6, 2034, takes on some cogency?
I think there's going to be an agency. We're going to talk about a bunch of issues about what's the appropriate size and scope of the agency that regulates the financial markets. To answer your question very specifically, in a globalized marketplace, and there's simply going to be increased pressure for there to be coordination among the world's securities regulators, there has to be a regulator in the United States of the size and scope appropriate to the global regulatory task, and that's something more than what the SEC's assignment is today. I think to be a global regulator, there has to be an agency with broader authority in the United States. What its name's going to be, I don't know. I wrote down the Investment Securities, Commodities, Markets, Trading Platforms, and Dark Pools Commission. It needs a better acronym than that. So let's just, brand name SEC. But no, the global task, and it's very easy to throw up your hands and say, the task of reinventing financial regulation in the United States is so vexing that how could we possibly imagine a world of securities regulation where that's coherent? But that's got to be the project, and I think whatever we do in Washington over the next year or two to reinvent securities regulation, to strengthen securities regulation, has to be with a view toward creating a regulator with a global voice.
All right. Donna, when the commission was initiated in the 1930s, we had a monoline world. Securities trading was different than commercial banking. Insurance was a state problem. Commodities regulation was trivial and non-financial. That's not our world anymore. As you focus on the evolution of what's likely to occur in financial regulation in the next 25 years, how does the SEC perform in this brave new world?
Well, I agree with Don. I think we're going to see a Securities and Exchange Commission that is more globally focused, more innovative, and focusing on not only the products that we have today, but trying to get ahead and figure out what products there are going to be down the road, and devoting a significant amount of agency resources, I believe, to working to better understand what is going to be happening. So in addition to innovative, more forward-looking.
All right. Let me, on this first question, turn to my old friend Bob Thompson. That is, my friend of many years, not old. Bob Thompson, tell me about the SEC in 2034. Will it exist? How is it going to be different?
We can look back to the SEC's origin, which was during a time in which there was a real belief in experts could solve the problems, bring them in the government, rein in markets, and let experts do it. And the SEC is still a product of that, and there's still a need for that. If you think about the kinds of agencies, the SEC is an independent agency. Contrast the last crisis. After 9/11, Homeland Security was created as a cabinet department. A bunch of agencies were rolled up into an executive agency. Contrast that to the last year, in which all the discussion is how we solve systemic risk or financial products. We solve these by using independent agencies that are outside the executive department. So I think this heritage of expertise, the heritage of independence, and thirdly, the fact the SEC has always been able to harness the knowledge and the expertise of markets in a way that other agencies don't. Those things will still exist in 2034. Those characteristics will still be needed. And so I think it is clear that we will have an agency with those characteristics in 2034. And as someone who has spent most of my academic life with the SEC brand name, I selfishly want that to survive. But I can't offer a better name than what Don did.
Well, let me take one of the points you made where you referred to systemic risk, and this is clearly a topic that is receiving a great deal of attention in Washington. And there is a lively, not entirely public debate going on right now as to how we can address the type of systemic risk that beset our economy in aggregate terms when you see a 54% Dow Jones collapse between October 2007 and March 2009. In firm-based terms, when you see significant actors, whether you start with Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and AIG and Merrill Lynch, Wachovia, it's a very, very long and very depressing list. And we always seem to be reacting after the fact. And in effect, the inspiration that Congress has at the moment, is there a way to be ahead of the curve? Is there a way to better predict and obviate systemic risk? The debate in part at the moment is between those who are articulating a belief that we should dramatically empower the Federal Reserve System versus those who say, hold on for a moment, the Federal Reserve System knows some things very well but may not know investor or consumer protection very well. We need more of a council approach. Don, what is your view on the systemic risk issue?
Gee, nice easy question. We need a systemic risk regulator. I don't think the SEC has earned that responsibility. I don't think the Federal Reserve Board has earned that responsibility. I would be inclined to create a new group that has to be staffed by economists, financial people, and some lawyers too, that will have authority to speak to systemic risk. But I think it's absolutely essential, I could take your question in so many directions, absolutely essential that that task, as important as it is, not shove aside the business of investor protection. The study of prudential regulation versus securities regulation, as you know, goes back many decades in many different countries. And one thing you discover about prudential regulators is they like to keep secrets. They don't like bad news being sent out. I think our economy is properly built on a high degree of transparency. I think only if there is an investor financial protection function situated outside of prudential risk that has authority and autonomy. If we don't have that, we're going to be in deep trouble. The question is, how then do you separate the two? I think we need at least twin peaks. We may need another peak beyond that, but at least twin peaks. How do you separate the two? And that gets very difficult, because if you were to say the systemic regulator can claim something like short sales, after all, short sales can be destabilizing, they can certainly introduce risk into the system. If that trumps the SEC's historic ability to address short sale type issues, again, we're in trouble. There has to be a division of responsibility that I think allows autonomy. Who's the tiebreaker going to be? I think my inclination would be to leave it to Congress, to let there be a public playing out of conflicts, rather than try to internalize dispute resolution as between prudence and disclosure into a single structure. So I think that's the task. I think you design a framework based on something like a Twin Peaks model, and you have to tolerate, I think, some degree of conflict because I don't want a monolithic financial regulator.
No, even the very term systemic risk embraces two different concepts. The one is to recognize that we're dealing with systemic challenges to a financial system that are not monoline. The other, when you emphasize the risk, is that sometimes these are very fast-moving challenges, and we're all well aware of emergency meetings long into the night, typically always starting on Friday and going till Sunday. Where someone has to decide, does Lehman Brothers live or die? How do you address Bear Stearns? And I don't think we can leave that to Congress. We have to have something in place. Let me turn to Donna. The question of how one addresses systemic risk, which is clearly at the top or near the top of issues being focused on right now, what would your advice be if let us say, Congress said, Professor Nagy, we now want you to be Tsarina of the universe. Tell us what to do.
Certainly there are some advantage for a single entity in charge of systemic risk. And certainly there's the proposals I'm most familiar with, or the Federal Reserve would be that single entity. I tend to favor more the council approach. I do think that bringing a number of experts from a number of agencies around this issue and putting them in charge, a council of five regulators, where I think the Securities and Exchange Commission certainly deserves a place on that council. But recognizing that the Federal Reserve, other banking regulators certainly have expertise in this area and more targeted expertise in terms of risk than traditionally the Securities and Exchange Commission has.
Now, when you focus on what may be new legislation in the 2009 calendar year, it will not just be an agency, whatever its name, or a council, whatever its name, is dubbed the Systemic Risk Administrator. But there'll be a lot of detail. substantive detail. And one of the issues that's been floated is whether or not, above and beyond the typical full disclosure emphasis of securities law, or the safety and solvency emphasis of prudential or banking regulation, there should be concepts that are being popularly associated with what's called a proposed Financial Products Commission. And these, for securities lawyers, are typically more merit regulation concepts. If, let's now make Professor Gabaldon's arena of the universe, if you were advising Congress as to how to address systemic risk, should this be part of the mission or objective of the new systemic risk administrator?
If I were Zarina, I would echo things that both Don and Donna have alluded to already. But I certainly would also say, and I would say that, to my mind, protection of consumers per se is not necessarily, to me, central to the notion of regulation of systemic risk. It's an important task, and I think someone should be doing it. And as I go down that road, I start to recognize that bundling securities, mutual funds, that sort of thing, into a consumer protection agency, to me, doesn't quite make sense, because to me, those types of investments do relate much more centrally to systemic management. Now, that doesn't mean that we haven't all learned that mortgage lending practices may also tend to have destabilizing effects. But I do think that you can sort out the consumer end of that much more neatly as opposed to the packaging, repackaging kinds of things which do go over the line to the system as far as I'm concerned.
One of the challenges, let me turn to Bob at this point, in the contemplated approach to systemic risk touches upon another note that you sounded in your first statement, and that is the significance of the independence of the SEC. The Department of Treasury, of course, is not independent, but it's had a significant role in designing proposals and apparently in crafting current proposals from the Obama administration. The Federal Reserve System is, but what has changed and doesn't get spoken about much is so much of federal policy is now made on a collective basis, whether we call it a council or president's working group. What risk does a systemic risk administrator, if it is not a council, pose to the independence of the SEC? How does one harmonize the securities expertise that several on this panel have praised with the challenge of trying to avoid the next debacle?
I think the real risk is that securities regulations gets lost with a systemic risk regulator. As I look back over the last year, if you think about how the debate has changed since August, for most of that period of time, the focus has been on systemic risk regulator, and the Fed has been the prime candidate for that. At different points in time, we've had discussion about financial products regulator. Professor Warren has pushed that very effectively. What is missing from that is the traditional expertise, the value added, the relative expertise, relative value of the SEC, which is not systemic risk and not necessarily consumer regulation financial products, but is the exchange part of the name. It's the market part of the name. It's the expertise part of the name. And if we go to a systemic risk regulator, think about the discussion last fall when the Fed was going to do it all, more like the UK. I kept wondering what's going to happen to the things that matter to investors and to the markets. And I think that's why there needs to be at least a Twin Peaks, as Don said. But then the question is, how do you coordinate it? We have the President's Working Group. Who chairs that? The Secretary of the Treasury. That's a different model. Again, I go back to my first point. If you think about how we do science regulation in this country, it's through a different model without the same independence that we have in finance is different. Money is different. We want independence for money regulation. We have a greater sense we're all together. We all rise or float, fall together. And so we want some insulation from the pure political process without separating it from the political process. And I think that part, systemic risk, hopefully will not occupy our attention for the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, maybe even 75 years. But the market regulation concerns are going to be with us regularly. And so we need to have a plan, a model that deals not just with systemic risk, but with what's been done since 1934. And that needs a separate regulator.
Let me turn to Lyman at this point. When we use phrases like Twin Peaks, we're talking about two levels of federal regulation. But when you focus on our securities regulation today, there are, I believe, 53 states and other jurisdictions which provide blue sky regulation. Indeed, if you look at aggregate personnel, there are actually more people involved in securities regulation at the state level than at the federal level.
Yes.
Don's point is absolutely right that there is increasing energy going towards globalized markets. What happens to state regulation if we move to a new world with greater powers in the federal government for systemic risk or otherwise? And we'll talk in a couple of minutes about the scope of what this might involve. Do we still need state regulation? Do we need a different kind of state regulation? Do we need a different type of coordination with the federal government?
Yes, I mean, it does raise issues not only of regulatory competence, but in our democratic society, it raises issues of federalism. And historically, the states have been important regulators of securities, and they bring a lot of expertise as well as personnel. They can examine a lot of regulatory ground much more closely than can the SEC or certainly any global authority. So I think as part of what I mentioned in my first comment, part of this move toward consolidation is not simply a consolidation within the federal government, but I think there are many people that would try to upstream state regulation into federal hands. And I think many of the arguments that would be made on behalf of states are the usual arguments that are made on behalf of federalism. When someone doesn't like a particular regulatory landscape, such terms as fragmented or fractious or balkanization are used. But when one wants to advocate its advantages, one can use such terms as pluralism or diversity or multiple vantage points. And I think it does relate to systemic risk, because I think Joel made an important point in his first comment. Systemic risk is a term that is used with precious little definition. And I think there's a difference between dealing with systemic risk once it is upon us, as the Fed and Treasury had to do last fall, and dealing with systemic risk by trying to identify, investigate, report, and share information about those practices, those institutions, and those markets where systemic risk may be created before it actually blows up into a full-scale problem. And I would advocate the virtues of multiple vantage points. Certainly, again, as at the federal level, there has to be thought given as to how do we coordinate this information. But I think there will be an enduring role for states. And I think, like many administrative agencies, it will be incumbent on those bodies to make the case as to why they can continue to be effective enforcement agencies.
Now, above and beyond what has happened in finance and what is happening in Congress, the Supreme Court very recently granted certiorari in a case which focuses on the constitutionality of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. The 2-1 decision of the D.C. Circuit affirming constitutionality had a very intense dissent by Judge Kavanaugh, and an author who has focused a great deal of attention on the constitutionality is with us, Donna Nagy. Donna has argued that the presidential appointment process in the PCAOB is unconstitutional, and that was certainly a theme that Judge Kavanaugh echoed. I'm not going to ask her to tell us how the Supreme Court will come out, and I'm not going to ask her to reprise her article, but I am going to focus on the Washington question. Suppose the Supreme Court, by whatever vote, does decide that the presidential appointment process in the PCAOB is unconstitutional and Congress continues to believe the PCAOB is valuable. What should Congress do at that point?
As Congress provided in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the five members of the PCAOB are appointed by the five SEC commissioners. And so the argument now before the Supreme Court is that these five members of the PCAOB are, in fact, principal officers, and the Constitution provides that principal officers must be appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. So in answer to the Washington question, if the Supreme Court finds that the current structure of the PCAOB violates the Appointments Clause, I would say that Congress should take the 10 minutes or so to rewrite that provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and to provide for presidential appointment and Senate confirmation of the five PCAOB members. I think the issue is even if we resolve the constitutional issue, I think Congress should spend maybe 13 minutes or 14 minutes to work on some redrafting. As Congress enacted the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, or as Congress wrote in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the PCAOB was initially created as not an entity of the federal government, and the Sarbanes-Oxley Act expressly provides that no member or employee of the PCAOB shall be a member of the federal government. It's very interesting then for the Supreme Court to have to decide, well, what deference do we give to Congress when Congress itself has made the decision to make this a private entity? For purposes of the Constitution, Congress can't do that, and the PCAOB conceded in the initial round of the litigation that, at least for purposes of the Constitution, the PCAOB is part of the federal government. But even if we resolve this appointment issue, the language in the statute still has the PCAOB as a private entity, which would mean for other purposes, non-constitutional purposes, the PCAOB would not be subject to, for instance, the Freedom of Information Act or the Sunshine Act or the Administrative Procedures Act. And so I think when Congress, if Congress goes back to the drawing board, it should rethink this whole private entity question and make the PCAOB a part of the federal government for all purposes.
Let me take a different issue with Don. Don, one of the challenges historically with the SEC has been a kind of episodic disconnect between market booms and the regular, the budget of the agency, and really staff size. A number of people, and I have to confess I'm one of them, have periodically written and urged that the SEC should be self-funded along the lines of the Federal Reserve or the FDIC. I know you have a bit of skepticism about this. Let me ask a two-part question. First, is this a real problem? Do we need to do something? And second, tell us about your skepticism.
Sure. The SEC is grossly underfunded, and we have to disconnect the issue of does it need more funding from the how do you go about funding it. On the first, you know, I've played the following thought experiment. Suppose God's assistant took you to the top of a mountain and asked you to look out at, we've heard these numbers so many times, 12,000 public companies, 5,500 broker-dealers, 11,300 investment advisors, 4,500 mutual funds. And then you notice there are a lot of creatures running in between those. And ask, how much money would you need to police that world that you see out there? First of all, you'd be dumbfounded. And then if somebody said, how about 4,000 people and, you know, a roughly $900 million, $1 billion budget? You'd laugh. You'd say to God's assistant, no way. So the number has to go way up. The question becomes, how do you assure that? What you want is a stable funding source. And my skepticism is really one of stability. We've seen many broker-dealer firms where the compliance function, which is funded by transaction-driven revenue, goes way up and way down, depending on market conditions. That would be unfortunate from the SEC's perspective. If we could create a stable funding source that allows the commission to address these very tough issues on a real-time basis, I'd love to have it. I just don't know how I invent that funding system that isn't market sensitive.
Well, I guess I would suggest let not the perfect be the enemy of the good. The system at the Fed and the FDIC may not be perfect, but it seems to be more effectual. And to take it a second order, obviously there are many details that would need to be addressed if this was implemented for the Commission, including compensation levels so that you can retain qualified senior staff.
Right.
But having said that, the challenge we have is the current system does not seem to function well during market booms.
Absolutely right. And my is purely skepticism about designing a funding source. It really does have to be a dynamic system. It can't be every broker-dealer shall pay X amount of money because the numbers change, consolidation. That doesn't provide you with enough stability. And once you start getting into the question, well, what should each year the tax or the levy be to support it, you're getting into fundamentally political questions that I'm doubtful Congress would ever leave to the agency.
I'm an academic, so I have the highest possible respect for Congress. Let me turn to Lyman. Lyman, you talked about federalism. Realistically, one of the most critical aspects of securities regulation today involves self-regulatory organizations. Mm-hmm. The leading one, and I speak with some bias because as with the chair of the SEC, Mary Shapiro, who was the previous CEO and chair of FINRA, I'm on their board of governors. Question is, as you go forward, proposals have been suggested to address, do we need to amplify the scope of SROs? That is, should FINRA, for example, not only address broker-dealers, but address investment advisors? And this question took on real acuity during the Bernie Madoff case. FINRA's regulatory mission, essentially, is broker-dealers. Mr. Madoff, by all public accounts, not only claimed to be a broker-dealer, but an exempt investment advisor, as well as a hedge fund. If we can strengthen the ability of securities regulation to work at the SEC and indeed the federal level through effective SROs, do we need a broader scope for the existing SROs?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, I think in former Secretary Paulson's blueprint of 2008, there was sort of a dual thrust to it. One was a decided consolidation of functions at the federal level, and the other was sort of a movement in the opposite direction of a lot of reliance on SROs. SROs certainly have advantages. They are sort of on the ground. They're nimble. They understand what's happening in markets and among the actors on the markets. You know, I think they're always subject to some concerns. And that is whether they are going to be more allegiant to the interests of the public as opposed to various constituencies, be they broker-dealers or advisors, or listed companies in some cases, or even investors as to those SROs that are publicly held. Other SROs, there could be exit from SROs. For example, those that are subject to regulation at the exchange level could simply delist. I mean, there are possibilities for exiting. As far as the point that you raise, I mean, I think that FINRA has come under some criticism for a number of things, not simply not having perhaps a broad enough scope, but they provide rather flimsy data on certain things that are within their traditional scope, and that is disciplinary proceedings and some other matters. So I don't think that SROs politically and from a policy standpoint are going to be a centerpiece of reform. I think there's much that can be done, but I think in the current environment, they're going to play more of an ancillary role than a central role.
Well, let's focus on what is likely to be another centerpiece, and I'll turn to Teresa. Scope. There are vast areas in the financial landscape today that essentially are not regulated. These include credit default swaps, OTC derivative, hedge funds, among others. There are other areas, such as municipal securities, which are regulated through a somewhat different system than conventional equity regulation or securities regulation. I guess retaining your Czarina powers, if you were going to address Congress, that your priorities for expanding scope would be, what would you focus on and why?
To tackle the easiest part first, I think, I certainly would think that it is high time to bring municipal securities into the tent of the SEC and to regulate in that area in a fashion that's much more parallel to the issuance of by non-municipal issuers. I think that the federalism issues that once seemed to cloud the area have fallen away. We have come so close to actually mimicking that type of regulation through the back door of broker-dealer regulation. It seems to me that it's time to simplify and to make it much more parallel. With respect to the other gaps to which you refer, I don't think I've ever met an academic, although pardon me if there is one sitting right here, who thinks that it was a good idea not to give the SEC jurisdiction over financial futures. When you're talking about systemic risk regulation, the idea that you don't have a single regulator who is looking both at the regular financial products and financial futures as well just seems to me to be unjustifiable. Now, I understand that at least today, we're not talking about an actual merger of the SEC and the CFTC, but that could change. We might be talking about it differently in another couple of days. I definitely could see a merger of the functions as far as financial futures are concerned, but having a sort of a stripped-down CFTC survive with respect to agricultural commodities. But again, I think that the only justifications for keeping the SEC from regulating in the financial futures, derivatives, et cetera, area have to be fairly blatantly political.
Let me turn to Bob, and I think in fairness, I'll now make you czar of the universe, and later I'll catch up with Lyman and Don, but I'm not going to withhold any powers here. Bob, hedge funds. How would you address hedge funds in this potential new system of financial regulation we're about to likely see?
I think we're heading to more regulation, which is an easy answer. As to what it is much harder. I think the big challenge is a point Don alluded to earlier, in the sense that hedge funds, and Don's point was about prudential regulators not wanting to have a lot of transparency, and hedge funds don't want to have a lot of transparency, and there's going to be a pushback about this that's going to happen perhaps this summer. I think the SEC is actually well positioned for that, because it's always dealt with the issue of when is information valuable when it's not disclosed, this particularly on the stock exchanges. I mean, floor brokers, it's the way that you trade without information. Dark pools deal with the question of information versus no information. I think we've got to face the same issue with hedge funds. And I don't know exactly what the parameters of it will be. I think there will be a systemic element to it, but there will also be a trading element to
it? Let me give you a hardball question there.
Well, I was afraid you were holding back.
One of the issues that a future type of hedge fund regulation will contemplate will be, will there be transparency with respect to short sales? And there are certainly some hedge fund managers who will argue, if we have to disclose short sale interest, we're out of business. And there will be others who argue that, look, if you're concerned with systemic risk, we don't have any problem with relevant information going to some systemic risk administrator. What we're concerned about is the companies we're short selling knowing about it. Now, this is a quite different approach than the Commission has typically taken with respect to market data.
And it's hard. I think we'll see disclosure to systemic risk regulators, and my guess is that will happen. I think it's much harder to figure out what's going to happen in terms of public disclosure. And my guess is that, in one sense, over the credit crisis, hedge funds per se was not the push point where disaster happened. And so my sense is that this is going to evolve, but I think we may not see that kind of disclosure because you can make an argument as to how the markets function, this will evolve, but my guess is we'll see disclosure to systemic risk regulators and not disclosure to the open market.
But you would assume there would be registration of hedge funds?
My guess is there'll be registration of hedge funds, and that'll be a 2009 item, if I were guessing.
Don, let me turn to another scope area that's received a lot of attention, credit default swaps, OTC derivatives. I'll now make you czar of the universe so you can catch up with the others.
I'm God's assistant. So.
Whatever.
Higher or lower.
And by the way, please proceed however you wish.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Or Tim Geithner already has that job. So, there is no, this issue has bounced around. I think the Commission is, in its public statements, individual commissioners and staff, it's done a very good job of trying to get its arms around an issue that is really unsolvable. On a systematic basis. Yeah, credit default swaps emerged as initially customized arrangements among two counterparties to meet very specific needs. Over time, they standardized, as most contracts do. But there's nothing inherent about them that makes them inevitably or highly standardized. So, of course, what we want to do is push them onto trading platforms, clearing mechanisms that give us a handle on as much as possible. But the more we push in that direction, the more the temptation is going to be for any two given counterparties to defect from the system by saying, no, what we want to do is different from the standard. We want to do customized. And unless you've got a good answer, can you, somewhere in the world of finance, customize or not? And something that focuses trading in a particular direction, then you're simply going to reinvite the dark pools phenomenon. We are going to have, whatever you call it 10 years from now, emerging into whatever world was left open rather than the standardized world. And unless you're going to shut the doors and windows absolutely completely to that, I doubt there is a very an easy solution to the problem. What would I do as whomever I am? I think it has to be twofold. Move as much of this trading as the market will tolerate into clearing platforms, however you want to describe it, to get the margin type regulation and the transparency. But then you have to go back to what you just asked Teresa, which is, and Bob, with respect to customized, do you really want to shut that world down? Yeah, I think innovation is really important for the United States in finance. I do not want a system where you can't design something that you need until you get, you know, a year or two of regulatory oversight. I think the direction has to be, you know, I think you have to leave the windows and doors at least partially, if not significantly, open, and then identify the systemically important institutions where you're going to look as a regulatory matter at what they're doing on exchange, off exchange, whatever. That's going to be an uncomfortable world. That's not going to be an easy world to deal with, and it's going to be a globally challenging world. But that's the best I can do. I'm sorry.
Well, let me just see if we can tease out one other part of your analysis. Who should regulate credit default swaps and OTC derivatives?
The SEC. I'll give you the short answer.
Why?
Because, and again, CDS is such a broad range of what they might accomplish, but so many of them are specifically related to a particular issuer's credit risk, the bonds, the debentures, whatever, underneath, that I would not want a world that takes away, you know, that bifurcates the SEC's regulatory authority over primary debt, but then leaves open this other world. I'm for merging the CFTC into the SEC with the SEC as a surviving entity, and internalizing that futures function, notwithstanding all the political obstacles that stand in the way, because I don't know how I would draft the division of responsibility. And from time to time, the CFTC and the SEC play nice and agree on divisions of responsibility. That's all to the good. Historically, that hasn't been sustainable. And I think you need a more powerful solution to the problem. That's why I would keep pushing the merger issue, even though I'm fully aware of what the political obstacles are.
Let me, in our remaining time, maybe turn to a few other topics. Donna, another actor in the financial landscape who's received a great deal of attention in recent years has been the credit rating agencies. And obviously, credit rating agencies have an internal structural challenge. They're paid for by those whom they rate. And this has been a conflict of interest that has received a good deal of attention in Congress and elsewhere in recent years. There will probably be a number of new initiatives with respect to credit rating agencies. Would you address this fundamental conflict issue? How would you recommend the Congress go about regulating here?
The conflict issue is certainly one that we've seen before in terms of the issuers who are being rated are paying the raters. And so we saw it years ago with respect to research analysts and similar conflicts, and Congress certainly got to work on that, as did the Securities and Exchange Commission, as well as states, too. Bring out some of the points that Lyman made, and so that was certainly a group effort. Whether or not alleviating the conflicts has enhanced the quality or the amount of research, there's certainly many opinions about that, but I think conventional wisdom is saying maybe not. So I think we have to be very careful with the credit rating agencies, that we need to recognize the conflict. But I think that information is good, and information is good. More information is better. Certainly, we want accurate information as well. There's certainly been proposals bouncing around about investor-owned credit raters, And I think that certainly I'd like to see those explored more. I think the buy side here is a very sophisticated one. The consumers of ratings are often large institutional investors who certainly are very sophisticated. And so certainly having a more active road on the buy side and having some ratings come from that side, I think would do much to mitigate the conflicts.
Thanks, Donna. Lyman, an issue that's received a lot of attention, but quite different from the other issues we've discussed so far, has been executive compensation. And clearly, if you want to get a newspaper headline, this is a good topic to focus on. What should the SEC or Congress be doing with respect to executive compensation, whether it's with firms that are now receiving TARP or other special funds, or more generally?
Well, I'll make a forward-looking statement here, and that is that executive compensation will always be a hot-button issue. It's just inescapable. And also, I think it's pretty evident that there are a lot of faulty compensation models out there and that many boards of directors of public companies are being appropriately reprimanded for creating perverse incentives to engage in highly risky behavior. I think at the regulatory level, this has historically been a matter handled by state law, although many critics would say not very ably handled by state law. The SEC's role traditionally has been a disclosure role. We saw that a couple of years ago where they amplified yet again the kinds of disclosures that reporting companies had to make about executive compensation. See a little bit of substantive regulation through Sarbanes-Oxley in the prohibition on loans to officers and directors and through the clawback provisions where there are financial restatements. We certainly have overt federal regulation through the legislation Joel mentioned that those companies who receive financial aid now have their bonuses regulated. And Senator Schumer has upped the ante even further, seeking through his proposed bill on the Shareholder Bill of Rights to actually legislate a shareholder say on pay. I think at the state level, the problem is really a governance problem. Shareholders don't, within the system of corporate governance, have a say on pay. In fact, they don't even have a say on officers. They certainly could create that through bylaws. They could create a system whereby the shareholders, rather than the directors, actually elected and therefore compensated the officers. They not availed themselves of that. And so the debate has really been about shareholder access to the company's proxy statement, and that has been a very contentious issue for years. I think we see some resolution here through Delaware's recent amendment to its corporate statute that does permit, not require, but permit shareholders to amend the bylaws so as to permit shareholder nominees to be on the board of directors' proxy materials. But it's permissive. It doesn't, as such, regulate or limit. It leaves that to the bylaw proponents themselves. Now, interestingly, almost simultaneously, the SEC has floated its recent proposal that would mandate access. And a couple of questions that I would raise are these. First of all, as we all know, the proxy solicitation language of the statute, Section 14A, is pretty sparse. Doesn't say much. And the question is whether you can glean from the solicitation of proxies, which is a process-oriented statute, the ability to mandate that shareholder nominees be on the company board.
Let me take that question in a different direction and pose it to Teresa. Teresa, should Congress enact legislation which would unequivocally establish SEC jurisdiction to mandate access to the proxy, whether through the form that the SEC is proposing in a rule that I'm sure we will soon see the language of, but it's been described in press documents recently, and one of the traditional concerns has been the cost of access to proxies under 14A7, where shareholders do have access, has been so prohibitory that without a non-cost kind of solution through 14A8 or something like that is just not going to work. What's your view on that?
I would favor that type of legislation because I honestly don't see the opportunity for mischief that some of the detractors do. I think that allowing shareholders access for the purposes of expressing themselves with respect to the election of directors, with respect to executive compensation, could go a long way toward addressing the perverse incentives that others have referred to, and I honestly don't see the downside.
All right. Well, I think there will be a lively debate, but we'll see how it comes out. Bob, let me give you what will be the last question on the panel, because we're really honored that the chair of the SEC, Mary Shapiro, is with us, and I know I'm eager and all of us are eager to hear her thoughts on these and many other issues of the day. One of the saddest events of the last year has been the disappearance of the five largest independent investment banking holding companies. It is stunning that within a period of just months, we lost Bear Stearns, we lost Lehman Brothers, we lost Merrill Lynch as an independent entity, and then J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs became bank holding companies. This prompts a fairly interesting question. We've talked about systemic risk administrator, and we focused implicitly on information flows and avoiding crises and responding to them. But when you focus on financial supermarkets or holding companies, whatever they're technically characterized, they're not limited typically to insurance or banking or securities. They tend to cover the waterfront. Who should regulate financial supermarkets and why?
Well, the premise for your question, or at least what I would add to the premise, is if you look over the last 20 years, the share of finance to our gross domestic product has grown dramatically, at least until the last 12 months. But if you look for the period before that, and so the question is, and that's where those five firms grew, and that's where others, and so the question is, where did that come from? Did the functions disappear when the firms disappeared? And the answer is, yeah, I think we've seen a sea change. We've seen that the finance growth spurt of the percentage of compensation taken down that's been rising since the mid-1980s, I think has changed. And so I think we're in for a period in which finance returns perhaps not to what it was in the early 80s or late 70s or before, but to a more humble role. Now, does that change the regulation? Well, there's a greater need for government than there was, and I don't think the consolidated entity review was particularly a success story for the SEC. But I think there remains a need for government function, and the SEC is the best position to do that. So I think we'll see a reconfiguring of that basic function, and it will still exist, but it will be on a smaller scale because finance will be less important to the economy than it has for the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, let me thank a panel that has addressed a dazzling number of issues in 1 hour. I'm not sure we've got ultimate solutions, but I think they have suggested some of the complexity of the problems, and clearly this is going to be an ongoing evolution. I'd like at this point to shift gears. As I mentioned, the chair of the SEC, Mary Shapiro, is with us, and I will just offer a very brief non-biographical introduction. When I accepted my current job as president of the University of Rochester, my wife looked at me and said, "This is the perfect job for you. You will never be bored." Well, I must tell you, my life compared to Chair Shapiro's in the last 4 months has been placid. She arrived in the midst of an economic tsunami, a new presidency, determined to make financial regulatory reform a priority. The number of challenges she has faced in terms of regulatory initiatives, enforcement, personnel changes on an ongoing basis is dazzling. She's the right person to be leading the commission at this point. She's tough, she's fair, She brings an experience base not only from the SEC and FINRA, but also from the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which could not be more appropriate. And I guess I join everyone in the audience in saying, now that we have teased up 14 or 15 major issues for you in the time allotted, tell us what the answers are.
Joel, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. It's really an honor to be able to welcome you all to the SEC today to commemorate our 75th anniversary. And while it doesn't look like a lot of people in the audience, we are being webcast. And what I've discovered is that there sometimes are thousands of people watching. Lots of people have had the benefit of this really brilliant panel. And I really want to thank all of you, and Joel, you especially, for chairing it, but for your incredible insights. I found it fascinating to be able to listen to the thoughts that you had on everything ranging from our budget to our executive compensation issues that we're all facing to questions of dark pools and fragmentation, and really so enlightening and so helpful to us at the Commission. So thank you very much. I'm actually not going to answer any of those big questions because I know that I stand between you all and an ice cream social out in the lobby. But let me just say a few things, maybe to put a close to this afternoon's event. As you all know, and Joel perhaps knows better than anybody else, is because he is the true historian of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the keeper of our history. This agency was formed during a very difficult period in our nation's history. The stock market had plummeted, unemployment was skyrocketing, and Americans had lost so much, including their confidence in the marketplace. And it was really in response to that that our agency was born. We were created to be the investor's advocate, and for 75 years, that's what we've been doing, advocating for investors. And now here we are, 75 years later, we're emerging from an economic crisis that is very similar to that we faced in the 1930s. But this time we're being asked, are we really up to the task? And like all of you, I know the answer is yes, we are. Indeed, if we do our job correctly, if we perform at the levels I know we are capable of, we can help restore investor confidence, and in the process, perhaps even jumpstart the economy. That means doing what we do every day, uncovering fraud, pursuing swindlers, chasing the evidence, ensuring transparency and truthfulness, and focusing single-mindedly on the needs of investors. And since I arrived here about 4 months ago, I have seen every day the dedication and the commitment of the men and women who work here. I see how investigators and attorneys and accountants come in early and work long hours. I see how they advocate vigorously for their positions and pursue the evidence, no matter how complex the case may be. And I see an eagerness to live up to the high reputation all those who came before us earned for this agency. You know, we have a remarkable group of SEC staffers and an equally remarkable group of SEC alumni. And like me, you all know how much this agency does on behalf of investors, both big and small. We are acting today with a renewed sense of urgency and focus. In the area of enforcement, we've brought on a new director and a new head of our New York office, two top-notch prosecutors who appreciate the importance of bringing significant cases with meaningful impact. We've streamlined the formal order and penalty negotiation processes to make it easier to get matters through the system. We've assembled a team to revamp our complaint intake procedures so that we're better able to handle those million or so tips we receive each year. And we've begun to hire new skill sets and upgrade our training so we can keep pace with the new financial products and strategies created by Wall Street. On the broader policy front, we've engaged in an active rulemaking agenda. Last month, we proposed significant changes to the rules governing investment advisors who maintain custody of their clients' assets, all with the goal of exposing Ponzi schemes and other frauds earlier in the process. In the area of short selling, the Commission unanimously voted to propose two distinct approaches to limiting short selling, proposals that are intended to restore investor confidence. Later this month, we'll consider a series of proposals to strengthen the money market fund regulatory regime to ensure that investors are not buying a risk that they're not intending to purchase. And in the area of proxy access, we have already proposed rules that would enhance the ability of shareholders to nominate company directors. And next month, we'll take up a package of corporate disclosure information improvements around compensation policies. But there's still much to do in the regulatory arena, which is why we have been working closely with our fellow regulators to define the authority that's necessary to regulate the world of credit default swaps and hedge funds. And we're currently working with the administration to consider ways to fill any other gaps that may become apparent as a result of the financial crisis. And finally, just yesterday, I announced the formation of an investor advisory committee to give investors a greater voice in the work of the commission. We've been around for 75 years because the American public understands that we are here for them. And with your continued hard work, support, and commitment, I think our next 75 years, although I hope I'm not still here, will be even better. This is a tremendous agency, and I am proud once again to be a part of it. I thank you all for joining us today, and I particularly thank our panel for all of their effort.
Chairman Shapiro, thank you for joining us today to share your thoughts about the SEC and its future. We are sure that you and your fellow commissioners and staff around the country will continue to provide the critical function of being the investor's advocate in these changing times. I'd also like to thank our distinguished panel for an excellent job sharing their insights today on the future of the SEC. In case you missed it, or tell your friends, the program is now permanently preserved on our virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, and I encourage you to access it again at any time. Finally, congratulations to the SEC on its 75th anniversary, and thank you for being with us today. The Society is sponsoring an ice cream social. It's out here to the multipurpose room out to your left. So thank you all for coming, and good afternoon.